Josh Lim. He's the head of derivatives at Genesis Trading. Josh, how's it going?
Great, great. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I figured, you know, this space is kind of opaque, but you're one of the big players in the crypto vol space, especially running the OTC desk for derivatives at Genesis. So I thought maybe we could just kind of start by getting to know you. Like, you know, where did you grow up and where did you end up going to university?
Yeah. Kind of took a roundabout path to my current seat. I grew up in Texas, kind of in middle school and high school. And then went to MIT to study math and computer science for university. And I figured I would try to kind of do something more theoretical. But then I ended up kind of realizing, like, I didn't want to spend a career in kind of hard sciences or academia. And so I think, like a lot of people of my generation, kind of just decided to go into finance while I figured out, you know, what I want to do for the rest of my life, and kind of just ended up sticking with it. So out of school, I got a job at Goldman trading equity derivatives on the VODEX trading desk. So it was, you know, kind of like mostly OTC business with a lot of you know, hedge funds and pensions, endowments, you know, insurance companies, just large kind of institutions globally. Across a pretty wide set of products, right? So anything that was basically like non-vanilla options, you know, things like barriers and even like retail-centric products like autocallables, you know, things that had sort of any kind of path dependency or correlation component, or you know, and vol derivatives as well, like variance and vol swaps and things like that. So it was a pretty great sort of introduction into the world of, you know, volatility trading. It was a great survey of just the landscape of market participants and products and assets that you could write derivatives on. We also did a lot of sort of like hybrid type trades across different asset classes. So, you know, equities versus rates or FX or commodities. So yeah, that's kind of how I got started. And I was in that seat for about 5 years.
That's super interesting. So when customers are looking for this type of product, they just call you and say, like, I want something with this type of payout, so on and so forth. You guys price it out, and then they just basically, you know, take one of the sides, either sell it or buy it type of deal?
Yeah. I mean, the idea was to kind of, you know, serve up to people very bespoke trades, very sort of customized to either, you know, their specific ask, or sort of tailoring, like, the product to be fitting some sort of thematic idea that we could sell to people, right? So, like, one idea that comes to mind is you did during is kind of when Shinzo Abe was in power. You know, there was this sort of idea of Abenomics, and a lot of people were just sort of putting on these trades of kind of Nikkei versus dollar yen. And you know, we would do things like dual binary trades where, you know, you know, one of the equities up and then the FX, you know, down, something like that, where you're sort of playing against the typical correlation of the FX pair versus the equity. We were doing things like that. And obviously, you know, there's some ways you can hedge the correlation risk in listed markets. Like, there's Quanto futures in Nikkei, you know, denominated in dollars versus like the local futures that are just denominated in yen. So we would do stuff like that, you know, but the majority of kind of what I would focus on was mostly on like US single stocks. So it would be things like overlays for, you know, sort of like fundamental thesis driven asset managers looking to kind of put on, let's say, like cheap premium on some name in their portfolio. Like, you know, you could envision like somebody's bullish on Apple, you know, they might want to take a long position in it in the cash equity, but then overlay that with some sort of like, let's say, a knockout call option or something, where they have a very specific view on like an upside target for that stock, and they might place a barrier sort of further out of the money than that. Obviously, like, these types of structures are much more common in FX, where it's like a much more liquid market, but in equities, you know, there's enough liquidity oftentimes in the underlying listed market for single stocks, like especially for names like Apple, like the large cap tech companies, that you can structure these sort of exotics on them.
That's fantastic. And so you were at Goldman for a while, and then were you looking at crypto like on the side while you were at Goldman, or like what, like how did you find your way into crypto throughout the years?
I mean, I think if you look back at that era, kind of between like 2012 to like 2016, like a lot of very successful people like came out of Goldman to start companies in crypto. I was unfortunately not one of them, but the people like Fred Ersham and Paul and Judith Gauchot, who started LedgerX, were actually on the equity vol desk with me.
No way.
So they actually went to Ledger, started LedgerX, and I had been in dialogue with them, and they introduced me to Jeremy Lehr at Circle, like the founder of Circle. So that's kind of how I got started. My first job in crypto was actually working, building out the treasury desk at Circle. And then, eventually that was more of a, building the pipes in the back to sort of like source liquidity for the retail trading platform at Circle at the time. This is before Circle became like a stablecoin issuer, which was much later in their sort of like progression as a company. But at the time, it was a treasury business that was sort of allowing customers to buy and sell crypto and use it for payments. And so, that was kind of the first taste I got of crypto, was building that platform, which then became much more of a trading business because obviously we were trading a lot with our retail customers, but then sourcing that from exchanges and sourcing that from bilateral OTC trading counterparties and things like that. So I actually worked a lot with Dan Matuszewski, who's founder of CMS. He was a trader on the desk as well with me, and he grew that business much bigger than kind of when I was there. But he, obviously Circle became like one of the top three OTC dealing desks at that time, like going into the 2017-2018 ICO bubble. So that was like a big outgrowth of the initial sort of the treasury operation, which became much bigger as the OTC desk.
Wow, that's fantastic. And it's pretty interesting to hear that like a bunch of traders from GS went out and started companies in crypto. That was kind of the same experience at DRW. Like a lot of the that alumni kind of went out and started in crypto. And so when you were at Circle and you were running treasury management, eventually you find your way into Genesis. So what was that transition like?
I think the path I took was more kind of following the trend of the general crypto market. So, I've mostly been in sell side suits. So just, I really kind of enjoy the interaction with the clients and, trying to see all the different flows that are going on in the market and kind of synthesizing that into, thematic trends that are happening and just sort of like helping clients to kind of figure out what those trends look like and kind of the best way to express them. Obviously with derivatives, there's just so many things you can do. And derivatives also just afford you, a more sort of greater dimensionality, right? In terms of what you trade in crypto. It's not just, you can go long or short spot. You can take views on vol, you can take views on skew, you can take views on relative value in a much more precise way. So, I think over time, because things just became, there became much more complexity in the product set. First it was perpetuals, it was all on BitMEX at the time. And then, over time there became, more exchanges where you could do sort of like relative value across exchanges in the derivative space. You could do a lot more basis trading between spot and futures. And then when Deribit came around, kind of, 2017, 2018, people started trading more and more in the nonlinear space and options. So I kind of just followed that path, to be honest. I was a Galaxy for a little bit, trading kind of the spot OTC desk. And I sort of got the derivatives business off the ground there as well. And I realized like it was going to be much bigger as a product category in crypto. So I kind of went around and talked to Genesis, amongst other places, and you realize like Genesis had this really unique franchise. It had a very big sort of lending business already, which meant that it had a big balance sheet. It had a lot of sort of bilateral relationships established in the market. And it had a willingness to sort of like grow the product set that it was offering to basically what looked like a prime brokerage kind of franchise. So it made sense to kind of grow the, establish and grow a derivatives business at Genesis. So I came over in 2020 and in a kind of a weird time, actually. It's like I joined right after the kind of the blowout in March of 2020, once COVID started hitting every market. At the time I was very concerned making that transition, just was kind of asking the desk, like, hey, are you guys okay? Do I still have a job here? I think Genesis like weathered that storm pretty well. And obviously since then, we've seen a couple of cycles come and go in crypto. Since 2020, even just in the last couple of months, we've seen a lot of turbulence in the market. I think one of the big things, about a diversified business like Genesis, being part of an even larger diversified business in Digital Currency Group, which is our parent company, is that, it gives us a lot of stability, like for the long run. So that's one of the reasons I really enjoy being in the seat.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so how big is your team as far as like headcount goes? And then, if let's say Deribit has, $5 billion of BTC notional OI, what kind of volume and open interest does the Genesis OTC desk do in proportion?
Yeah, that's a good question. Generally speaking, it doesn't always work out like this, but right now there's less interest in trading bilateral OTC, but historically we've done, let's say, like an even split between our listed kind of business line versus our bilateral OTC business line within derivatives. The listed side of our business is much more centered around like paradigm execution. So basically block trading, mostly derivative blocks. We do some on CME as well. And bid.com and, some of the other venues. And then on the bilateral OTC side, it started off as a small business and it's now a pretty big one. A lot of it is, under ISDAs that we execute with our counterparties before we start trading. And, we manage the collateral that goes back and forth between ourselves and the counterparty bilaterally as well. So there's obviously a lot of sort of operational work, legal work, and sort of onboarding compliance work that goes into sort of maintaining all these bilateral relationships. We don't have, thousands of these relationships. So it's manageable as part of our overall sort of operational platform within Genesis, right? Between sort of the lending business and the spot trading business, we have a really great ops team that can kind of manage all these different processes. But obviously, like as the markets, have evolved in crypto, we're seeing a lot of really good platforms pop up and sort of vendors that give us, ways to automate these sort of processes. And I think, my thesis is kind of in the next couple of years, we'll see a lot of people, maybe that look like me, that look like my counterparts at other trading desks, kind of spin out and do their own thing in crypto, where they're building towards these gaps, right, in market structure. I think that's really important, right? You need people who kind of have been in the market, have domain expertise and market structure within crypto to understand, like, here are the gaps. Like, there needs to be, accounting, software that does this, or, trade reporting software that, can submit these trades to an SDR or something like that. So there's a lot of different pieces that, people are independently working on. Paradigm Salt, the big piece, obviously, with just sort of, price matching between counterparties and reporting them to clearing venues. But there's going to be a lot more, I think, over time. So, yeah, I think to answer your question about market share, it's hard to say precisely. I think generally speaking, we've been like near the top or number one for paradigm block trades historically for the last like maybe 6 to 9 months. I think for it depends on the day, but generally, if we aggregate all of our volumes bilaterally and OTC, bilateral OTC and sort of block trades, we're probably something like 10 to 20% of derivative listed volume.
Oh, that's great. That's pretty big. That's interesting. And now, as far as like kind of new products and stuff like that, do you guys get demands for quotes for like altcoin options. You get demands for quotes on like sort of exotic type of options and invariant swaps and stuff like that. Is that a field that you guys are you play into?
Yeah. I think over time, we've evolved the set of things that we will quote. It's still hard to sort of manage, exotic payouts in large size, right? Because you have to be able to manage your gamma risk, like on barriers and things like that. And then obviously for like variant swaps or anything, like these vol derivatives kind of have to be able to replicate the strip of options, right? So there's still, it's still hard to do that, I think, both from like a software, automation perspective, executing the strip, but also from like a liquidity perspective. There's sometimes like for far out of the money stuff, there's not great liquidity. So we're quoting it, and I think a lot of our other counterparties in the market are also sort of looking at this. And I talk to a lot of my counterparts at other trading desks occasionally just to see like, what's possible out there. Maybe we can cross something. We've quoted a bunch of things for people. I don't think we've traded a lot. I think there are a lot of retail platforms out there, a lot of Asian trading desks, actually, like the ones that, talk to miners and things like that, that will touch some of the more exotic payouts. And there's a lot of firms actually that are coming up now. One that we work closely with is called Enhanced Digital Group. I think they recently kind of got off the ground, and they're working on exotic payouts and offering that as a principal trading desk. And we work with them as well to kind of back hedge a lot of the stuff that they're doing. So I mean, we expect to see a lot more of this sort of like niche risk providers in crypto.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's pretty exciting. I think that really grows the space, and we'll see like more volumes growing and open interest because of things like that. So real quick, touching on, you mentioned, there's the pandemic crisis in March of 2020, and then a couple other notable events since then. I'd like to just touch on sort of the most recent market sell-off with Three Arrows and Voyager and Celsius. Can you maybe just touch on like, what's the theme of what happened there and kind of the broad details? And from your perspective, running the derivatives desks, how did you react and how did you mitigate that risk on your side?
Yeah. I mean, it all kind of started with, if you think back to sort of December of 2021, right, where the narrative really started to be about the Fed tightening up, and also just inflation running hot, right? So I think at that time, crypto, we saw just kind of a broad rotation out of crypto from a lot of our sort of larger institutional trading counterparties, right? So folks that had sort of come into crypto over the course of 2020, 2021, allocated a lot of capital into this new asset class, and sort of traded around certain big catalysts, right, for crypto. Things like the Coinbase listing, right, in April of 2021, and the October sort of ETF approval on the CME futures. Like post all of that, I think we saw a lot of people start to de-risk. And I think that was really the first indication, that we're going to see the backside of this epic bull cycle, right? So starting in kind of 2021, there were still a lot of things that were sort of moving idiosyncratically, like you would see right at the tail end of a bull market. I think you saw a lot of people sort of trading around Luna, like it hit, $100 like a couple of times, right? And that was, I remember there was a time where it was just like completely uncorrelated with Bitcoin, and just the broader crypto complex. And I think, for a lot of people, like people kind of had the right idea, which was like, hey, we should sort of like do more market neutral strategies, right? Things like yield farming, things like stablecoin yield, basis trades, things like that. And I think unfortunately, like a lot of people were also in that sort of the anchor of like UST trade, right? Where if you look kind of across the different sources of yield that was really off market, right? That sort of like 20% yield. So that was kind of where it started. Like a lot of people had trades like that on, trades like the staked ETH, kind of the levered staked ETH trade, trying to kind of play for the merge later in 2022. Things like there are still sort of like overhang from other types of basis trades out there that people had on their books. And I think what we found, we all kind of learned the hard way in this market is like there's still, in this type of market, like liquidity is king, right? Like having sort of like access to the most highly in demand forms of collateral is most important, right? And so those forms of collateral ended up being kind of dollars and crypto and Bitcoin, like the actual underlying assets. That was kind of what became highly in demand in this sort of like credit crunch cycle that we saw kind of in the last couple of weeks. And I think a lot of firms had issues, right? Not just sort of the hedge funds that were taking risks, but also like a lot of lending desks. I think Genesis has historically been a very large lending business. We definitely were not immune to some of the effects that went on in the market. But I think we sort of navigated it the best we could, right? So we had collateral with some of the counterparties out there that were having issues, and we managed our exposure to that collateral and we liquidated where we needed to. And I think a lot of other desks were in similar positions and kind of acted in similar ways too. I think at the end of the day, it comes down to kind of, your ability to manage the risk, to absorb, the impact of those types of events, credit events. Do you have the reserves to absorb it? Do you have sort of retained earnings and the balance sheet to kind of weather that type of stuff? And so, I think over time, the kind of sharp impact, immediate impact of this credit event will fade, and we'll see a lending market come back that's maybe more robust, maybe more based on sort of fully collateralized repo type lending. I think there's going to be much more regulation on the types of retail kind of deposit taking platforms out there. I think that was, if you kind of look through the composition, right, of the lending market, there was the vast majority of it was sort of secured in some way. And then there was like an unsecured part of that lending market. And a lot of that was sort of tied to these retail deposit platforms. And so I think that's something that the market will have to kind of adjust to, the sort of new regulations. I think that'll come out of it, and probably fewer, less funding, I guess, available in that format for dealing desks and market makers and liquidity providers. And then the other thing I think we're seeing is just, there's just thinner liquidity, right, in the market, because liquidity providers, electronic market makers, even like StatOp guys, like rely on loans that come from lending desks like Genesis and others to kind of run their strategies and provide liquidity to the market. And that's dried up a little bit. That's reflected in volume being lower across the board. I think it's also reflected in things like, certain types of capital intensive strategies being less in vogue, right? Things like our strategy is across exchanges, things like, basis trades, things like even running like implied versus realized like vol spreads, right? That's requires a lot of capital or collateral on exchanges and things like that. So I think there's going to be sort of a period where people have to adjust to higher cost of capital across a bunch of different strategies. And when we come out of that, I think we'll see like more just market robustness, because people won't have sort of these let's say liquidity mismatches across their book.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so there's a couple of things I want to touch on that you mentioned. So real quick, with sort of the tail end of what you just mentioned, like doing implied vol versus realized vol being capital intensive. So that's just the idea of like, I'm selling options against the asset, and then delta hedging the realized vol. Like both of those things require a lot of capital. And if no one's there to lend me some money to fund that strategy. Basically, I won't run that strategy. And essentially, in a way, not only does that remove liquidity, but it also maybe allows opportunity to exist for these strategies because no one's kind of taking it. Is that the right idea?
I think that's right. I think that's right. There's a lot of things that, wouldn't in a normal sort of efficient market wouldn't happen, right? Like a good example of this is, post Terra, like a lot of stable coins were depegging, right? So you saw that with like Tether had a brief moment of depegging, and that became like a big thematic thing, especially with kind of TradFi institutional guys who viewed this as a kind of systemic risk for crypto. That one reason could be sort of a lack of faith in Tether and the quality of its reserves. But another reason could just be that, market makers that would normally just be buying Tether, below, let's say, 99 and 90, right? Where you normally would be able to sort of like redeem it for dollars. Maybe those guys were occupied doing other trades where they could make more than the spread that they were making sort of on the creation redemption trade for Tether. So I think that's a good example. I think the vol stuff is another good example. It's hard to say, right? Because everyone has a different approach for how they hedge, how they delta hedge their options book, and how they manage, margin across a lot of different exchanges. But if capital is more expensive, and I think in this type of market where there's so many of these, what look like kind of good risk reward, arb opportunities, as well as just good, general distressed asset opportunities out there, right? Like you can think about all of these firms that would love to have some capital, right, to sort of like continue running their businesses. There's a lot of opportunities to deploy capital and not enough of it out there in the market. So the cost of capital should be, I think, a lot higher than even what you would see on the futures curve. And I think part of it is, not every opportunity is accessible to every counterparty or every dealing desk or every capital allocator. So it just, things are very dislocated, I would say. So it definitely, like, people have different opportunity sets and different costs of capital. So it's hard to say anyone's doing anything wrong, right? I think it's just like, a lot of things aren't talking to each other in this type of market.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then you mentioned some of these sort of basis trades. I just want to visit a couple of them, just for people who might not be aware of these or unaware of sort of the environment, kind of why these went down. So I think what the two that really make a lot of sense to me are the Lido trade, which is basically the ETH 2.0 and the regular ETH that at some point should converge, when you can access your ETH 2.0 on the Beacon Chain or whatever it is. So that was trading at a discount to regular ETH because of a liquidity premium, essentially, because you don't get to access it until you merge. So therefore, people were kind of getting levered up and buying that Lido ETH and basically hedging it with whatever regular ETH futures or something like that, and just waiting for that spread to collapse. Is that the general idea?
That was, obviously one of the bigger trends in the market, involving staked ETH. The idea was, you're basically buying something that converts, at some unknown point in the future into ETH, like underlying ETH on the new chain, under proof of stake. If you go short ETH, the underlying ETH, and then you go long the staked asset, and you earn some yield along the way, then, if you can hold that to maturity or up until the merge, plus whatever 6 months, whatever it takes to kind of convert, and remove it from staking, then, it's a risk-free trade, right? Obviously, it's not a risk-free trade because, any time along that path, you might have a liquidity issue. So you might actually need to collapse a trade early. So that was the big issue. And obviously the uncertain timing of the merge kind of exacerbated the problem because no one really knew what the right discount rate to apply to it was.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then everyone's kind of crowded in this trade. So then if someone has to like get out of it, it like widens the spread. And then the next person behind them have to take marks down, and then they might have to get out because of the losses, which widens it more, so on and so forth. And the other one that's kind of interesting is the, and I think, this is DCG, your parent company, the GBTC trade, which is basically you drop, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you deposit actual Bitcoin with Grayscale. You get the Grayscale GBTC shares. They can go out in the market and sell them after a 1 year lockup, I believe. And then theoretically, that was trading at a premium at the time of deposit. So you theoretically capture that premium after the lockup period. But then what happened is that everyone got crowded in this trade and the premium went to a discount. So now you have to hold post lockup to kind of exercise and get out and get your original Bitcoin back. But the problem is that discount can get worse and worse and worse. And now what do you do type of deal? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I think it's roughly the same idea, right? Meaning it's sort of like a one-way trade where there's an uncertain timeline on which you can collapse a trade, right? And I think for some of the trust products out there, you can create, but the redemption side of it really is a function of the trust product being converted to an ETF, right? So that was sort of like the uncertain timeline for that particular trade.
That's interesting. So when since you guys are on this desk, you have a lending arm, you have the OTC derivatives arm. Do you guys get to see a lot of that flow? Like, maybe people are lending, or excuse me, borrowing from your lending desk to go into these types of strategies. I mean, theoretically, if we could spot crowded trades, that would be, valuable information. Is that something that is gleanable from being on an OTC desk, or is it still you see such a small part of a bigger picture that it's never really enough information?
I think you can see parts of the trade. We, in particular, because we're in a position where we're an affiliate of Grayscale, there's a lot of things that we can't touch, like in that trade. There's also a lot of things that we just don't have visibility to because there's information barriers between different companies, within DCG. So there's always, some uncertainty about that. But you can sort of read, stuff, especially for, let's say, for the say ETH trade, like you can see what's happening on chain, right? So you have a good idea of how the trade is being executed in terms of leverage. A lot of it was going through Aave basically for the leverage. So there's a lot of on-chain activity you can glean info from for the sort of things that are traded on exchange. Equitized products and things like that. Like obviously you can check like filing public filings to get a sense of like, who's got the trade on and kind of what their strategy is with that particular asset. So I mean there is a lot of public information out there in terms of like what is, being at an OTC trading desk, you do see a lot of those flows and you can sort of get a good aggregate picture of what's happening. And so that is, yeah, I mean, that's certainly like one of the things that helps being in a seat like this.
And so something you mentioned that's pretty interesting is the on-chain flows. And I think this asset class and this whole environment is so new that there's a lot of data assets out there, such as this on-chain data, that people might not have figured out yet or figured out how to use it yet or like turn it into a signal. I mean, do you think it's possible to find strategies looking at on-chain data or other data and make just directional bets and find edge just from a directional trading strategy? Like this thing is a great signal for getting long Bitcoin or getting short Bitcoin. Maybe it's exchange flows or it's days destroyed or whatever. Last how many days since this last transaction on all the wallets, stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, I do think so. Obviously, there's varying levels of kind of signal to noise on these types of strategies. I think with Bitcoin, I think what I found, I guess historically, is that there's a lot of things that can confound your signal, right? So, like for instance, like people sometimes just move large amounts of Bitcoin on chain between wallets that they control, right? Or like an exchange might be doing some sort of cleanup on their back end. that results in a lot of on-chain movements and things like that. It might be like very old coins too, so that might result in a lot of days destroyed. I think you can do this in an intelligent way if you like do, you know, actually spend a little bit of manpower cleaning up the data. But you know, it's hard to do it, I think, entirely systematically without correcting for some of these things that might be happening. There's also just a lot of, you know, just secular things that happen in market structure that will affect like the long-term reliability of your signal. So, you know, sort of the evolution of things from, you know, centralized spot exchanges to centralized derivatives exchanges to, you know, DeFi exchanges like DEXs in the spot space to, you know, DYDX and kind of the rise of like on-chain perps and things like that. All of these things obviously change the way things get transacted and really can screw with, like, if you're counting on sort of exchange deposits and withdrawals as your metric of kind of traded volume, that's going to really change over time if a lot of your market volume goes to DEXs, right? So, yeah, I think you have to kind of filter and screen your data, but there's good ways to do it. I think the signal maybe is a bit stronger if you consider smaller assets, like smaller cap assets. Mm. If you can just sort of focus on those assets that have very limited trading venues, and you kind of scrutinize what's happening on like a particular AMM for a particular small cap token, like obviously that will probably have a little bit more explanatory power. But then you can't really put that much capital to work on that either, right? Because it's a smaller scale strategy. So yeah, I think we see a lot of like smart people, you know, kind of working on these types of problems. That's a little bit less of what we do as a firm. Obviously, we're not taking a lot of that type of sort of proprietary, you know, trading risk. We're more of like a liquidity provider to people who are.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, kind of just moving on here, you mentioned on DeFi, small cap assets. Is there things that, not from a Genesis Trading perspective, but just from a Josh Lynn perspective, like some cool things that you see in the space as far as DeFi goes that your projects are excited about, or maybe tokens that you find interesting? I recently read one of Arthur Hayes's latest posts, and he's kind of fishing in the bear market for some high quality tokens, looking at sort of price to earnings ratios out in the space. Do you find any ERC-20 tokens or projects out there in the space that are interesting?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's a lot of very credible, you know, founders out there that are still kind of heads down working through this bear market, right? I think the areas that we see a lot of promise in are, you know, for instance, on-chain derivatives, right? So not just sort of the DOVs and the kind of option vaults protocols out there, of which there are a lot of really good ones that continue to kind of innovate. I think we're also seeing a lot of like perp kind of DEX type products out there that are getting off the ground, especially as kind of the base layers where you can execute are getting better over time, right? I think there's been a lot of sort of migration across different layer ones as people try to figure out like the right place to build these sort of financial products. That's going to continue to happen, but I think, you know, we're seeing like real interesting platforms being built at scales that make sense, where you can actually support, you know, a lot of volume, a lot of transaction throughput, things like that. I think there's still a lot of problems that need to be solved, right? I think some of the bigger questions are like, you know, an AMM, you know, like a constant product market is probably more of a hack than anything else, right? Because of the limitations of supporting like full order books on chain. So where is the sort of infrastructure going to go over time? There's been a lot of attempts to sort of like incorporate full order books and things like that into DEXs, and so I think that innovation is pretty interesting, that line of innovation. I think more products that look like that will be eventually displacing, you know, centralized markets that currently support order books, and maybe it'll eventually get to the point where it becomes like roughly, you know, indistinguishable to users, and you know, for a lot of users that is a benefit, right? Because there's you can try to use a bunch of these sort of derivatives exchanges and spot exchanges, and sometimes you'll run into issues because you're a U.S. citizen or something like that, right? So just the sort of like openness and universality of operating on chain, I think will be attractive to a lot of new users going forward.
Cool. And then one more question before jumping off to some fun questions and wrapping it up. On the DOVs, is that something that you guys participate in?
We do, yeah. We're usually a bidder on a lot of those options.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Awesome. Okay, so kind of last closing up questions here. So obviously, you know, running a desk, being ahead of a derivatives desk, OTC desk, a lot of work. What do you do to relax or do for fun outside of trading derivatives if you have time to do anything else?
I mean, it is a 24/7 market, I guess. No, it's been, you know, obviously like crypto has its own forms of relaxing, right? Like a lot of people travel for conferences and things like that. And it's something that's pretty unique to crypto, this idea of just like, you know, going to a remote location every couple of weeks and taking the whole industry with you. I think it's just part of like the way the whole market evolved in such a decentralized way where everyone's all over the world. I really enjoy that, just kind of meeting people face to face and in an exotic locale, and you know, just understanding a little bit better, right? Like how people are thinking about the market, like why they're doing the trades that they're doing in the market, and maybe how we can like help, you know, price things better and things like that. That's not really outside of my job, to be fair, but that's probably one of the best parts of the job.
Very cool. And then for any newer traders, is there any good books? Trading books that you like throughout their years, either options related or trading related?
Yeah, it's hard, right? Because it's like in crypto derivatives in particular, right? There's not really like an authoritative textbook or something that you can point to. Everything's so new. And the market structure is like still evolving pretty rapidly. I think I usually just tell people like if you don't have like an options pricing background at all to read like the Natenberg book, that's always like a good one to start. When you're like fresh out of all desk as a practitioner, it's pretty practical. That's the one I recommend to people.
Cool. Well, Josh, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate the insights into Genesis Trading. And everyone who tuned in, thanks for tuning in. Have a good one.